Okay, this week on Podcasting Softly, I have a guest that I've long awaiting to talk to. His name is Matt Caritas, but to a whole legion of fans, he was once known as Matt Hannon. Hollywood has a long history of cop movies. Among these illustrious, in this illustrious genre, we have many titles, including Ghost Cop, Banana Cop, Demon Cop, Cyborg Cop, Beverly Hills Cop, Vampire Cop, Robo Cop, Clown Cop, Maniac Cop, Kindergarten Cop, Time Cop, Psycho Cop, Kid Cop, Omega Cop, Karate Cop, Gladiator Cop, Wolf Cop, Cannibal Cop, Hollywood Cop, Vigilante Cop, Lunar Cop, Battle Cop, Midnight Cop, Border Cop, Android Cop, Future Cop, Base Cop, Zombie Cop, but today we're talking with the one and only Samurai Cop.
That is awesome. I'd like those back read back to me in alphabetical order, please.
Okay.
That's a plethora of cop movies, man.
It is.
Glad to be part of that club.
That's a whole lot of cop movies. But
I think we want is the worst cop genre movie ever. But that's all right.
We're talking about two of the greatest cop movies ever made.
Yeah.
Of course, that depends how many beers you've had.
Yeah, that's the prerequisite. I tell everybody. I said you've got to make sure that you've got alcohol in your system.
Matt,
or some other mind-altering drug.
Matt, as a fan first, it's really fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for your interest. I appreciate everybody. This is still a fun ride for me, even though it started, I don't know how many years ago, 3 years ago when I came back to life.
Yes. And in reading about it and in thinking about it, have you seen the documentary Searching for Sugarman?
Is that the guy that did the music or something?
Yeah, and he like disappeared, and everyone thought he committed suicide or he burned himself alive on stage or something like that.
Very, very vaguely I've heard that story or someone had brought it up.
Yeah, and when I heard about that story, well, when I saw that documentary, oddly enough, I thought about your story because I thought, yeah, here's a guy who, you know, I mean, the film sort of resurfaces after, I don't know, 20 years, discovered in a vault somewhere in Rome, and then all of a sudden it's out and about. They say some films are released, other films escape, and Samurai Cop was out again. Now, I actually saw Samurai Cop back in the VHS days.
Really?
And it was I think it was Polish, the video, because it,
where you had rented it at a video store?
Yeah.
Or you just had it given to you?
Okay. No. I rented it, well, my cousins rented it because they were into all sorts of action movies.
Good, bad
at the time.
Movies. Yeah. Right.
And I remember watching it on a double bill with like a Lorenzo Lamas movie. I think it was The Snake Eater. And my cousin said, I got out this movie, Samurai Cop, and we put it in. And when the subtitles came up, of course, it had like Polish, I think it's Polish subtitles, but it was the track was in English, luckily enough. Otherwise, we would have been, you know, sitting there with a Polish guidebook trying to figure out what was going on. But, and, I watched it and I didn't think anything about it. You know, I thought it was mostly funny for the most part. But I didn't see anything about it again until many years later I got a gift of the DVD, came out, which has a Joe Bob Briggs commentary track on it.
Right.
And I was like, wow, I remember, I vaguely remember, I said, I think I've seen this before, you know, and then I started watching it, yes, it's the same movie, and wow, like, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I started asking around, and there was this cult had sort of sprang up, and this new appreciation for Samurai Cop, and I thought, wow, you know, and it just exploded. And then of course, I sort of started doing research, you know, thinking, okay, what happened to the film? What happened to the people? And then obviously, I mean, there's some notables like Robert Zadar and Gerald Kimura, you know, who did other things. But then, you know, got to yourself, you know, at that time, Matt Hannon, and I was like, wow, he kind of vanished, right? And word is that he died. And I thought, oh, that's kind of sad, because now he's got this film out and it's got a cult following and he's nowhere to be seen to reap the benefit, as it were.
Yeah, the ridicule.
Yeah. But thank goodness you're alive. You're resurrected.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, there was quite a lore around that as far as where it was found and when it had popped up. But yeah, I believe Amir had originally sold it to some territory over in Poland.
Right.
And that's about it. Like I said, it never got any theatrical release or video release here in the U.S. So it just went away, and I never thought about it again. I just thought, oh, I could never use this for footage as an actor. But yeah, I never hid or anything. I just kind of got out of the business because it was just too Yeah. You know, it's a pain in the butt, especially all the hoops you got to jump through. And I just said, oh, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to go through all that. I'll wait till they call for me.
Yeah,
of course, right? It was 30 years later.
Yeah.
But
an overnight,
a little past my prime.
You're an overnight sensation. It took 30 years to get there.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So let's begin at the beginning. What's a nice boy? How did a nice boy from Oregon end up here?
End up where I am now.
Yeah.
I had grown up and obviously in high school had done theater and so on and so forth. And I thought, well, you know, this is kind of my calling. I was always a class clown since probably my earliest first grade, you know, elementary school years. And then I graduated high school and did everything that I could do there in Portland as far as local theater.
Right.
And I left Portland. I was probably a big giant, you know, weightlifter, thick, 270 pounds, looked like a linebacker. Steroid-free, of course. But I thought, let me go to Hollywood, and I like to be funny. Let me be kind of a John Candy-esque actor. I don't want to do action and, you know, that kind of stuff, obviously. But basically what Dwayne The Rock Johnson now is today is what I was kind of looking to do. And I came to California, and obviously you need a job when you get here. So I had friends that were in the security business, and that led me to the bodyguard job, which eventually got me working for Stallone. And then from there, I just, I think Sly had come back from filming Rambo 3, and I thought, you know what, I need to kind of get in a little bit better shape. And Sly didn't like us standing out so much when we would go out to dinners or clubs, and he thought, you know, you guys obviously look like bodyguards, try to trim down. So that's kind of when it hit me, the vanity and the narcissism, and I just shredded down to that 180. I think we filmed Samurai Cop at, I think I weighed about 230, so I went down from 270 to about 230, and then obviously my current wafy weight at 53 years old is about 175. But so that was kind of what it was. I just came to Hollywood, got a job. I was lucky enough to work for the biggest action star in the town, and then I pursued my own stand-up comedy and other stuff. And then I just, like I said, didn't want to jump through the hoops, get the headshots, go on auditions, this, that, and the other thing, and just raise my two daughters.
But it was interesting because the only information I had for the longest time comes from a Robert Zadar interview, which is on that particular DVD that I was gifted, in which he mentioned, that you were Stallone's bodyguard for a while. And another thing he mentioned that was kind of interesting, the only other thing he mentioned about you is that during the filming of Samurai Cop, you were eating a lot of turkey.
Well, I would always bring my own food to the set because, again, to look that way, it does take a strict diet besides the weight training. And all Amir was buying was fast food, Chick-fil-A and McDonald's and Burger King for everybody. So I also saw that same commentary on DVD when Robert had recorded it.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, you know, I just think throughout the years, that's just mainly, and I still do today, eat the same.
Yeah.
All white ground turkey breast with, you know, fruits, vegetables, everything else. But that was kind of my staple back then. It was just funny. He locked into that.
That was like the one thing. He's like, yeah, what do I remember that? He was a good guy. Ate a lot of turkey. But you can often tell by the quality of the film production by its catering, so... It was mostly Chick-fil-A, huh?
It was terrible. Yeah, because Amir didn't really have that. I mean, the crew loved it. They didn't care. But and Mark Fraser, my co-star. But I would always come with my own water, and it's just easier that way. I still do that, like I said, in my everyday life. That's kind of the key to maintaining. If you're into the aesthetic look of your body, you really gotta. It's hard. You can go out to restaurants and then just kind of order clean, but it's just easier for me to carry my own stuff. I eat a lot of electroceuticals and Chinese herbal stuff to keep the internal organs all healthy as I get older here.
Well,
but
there you go.
I'm kind of a nutball that way.
That's okay. Well, that's helpful information for the health conscious listening out there. Health, there's a potential thing for you, but good health with the Samurai Cop.
They keep telling me to put out a workout video and a diet video on the Samurai Way, but I said amongst everything else coming out with video games and poster, clothing lines, and everything, that's just crazy. It's nutty, but no, I don't think any fitness book's in the works.
That could be a really good late-night infomercial, actually.
I wouldn't go down that road. That's right.
come out with the Samurai Sword, and, you know.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Yeah. I'd be taking it too far. I just enjoy the little bubble world of the cult, the fans who, like I said, just keep popping up. Even in my regular 9-to-5 life, it's amazing the crossover. That I'm just down at my local grocery stores now, and kids, you know, checking me out at Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, which are, you know, local store, are recognizing me. And I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. This is just insane. It just keeps on, getting more mainstream. And of course, with Tommy's movie, who was the co-star with me in Samurai Cop 2, Tommy Wiseau, also being a legendary cult film, you know, guy, Seth Rogen and James Franco made the movie about his story called Disaster Artist, which comes out here in December. So I'm afraid the two worlds will collide, and we may cross over cult world into mainstream, and they'll go, who are these nutty hair, long hair guys?
Yeah, no, I thought it was ironic. Finally saw Samurai Cop 2, because I remember, I try to listen to some of the other interviews so I don't rehash a lot of the old quotes, but I thought it was, I thought there was some great irony, because before Samurai Cop 2 was released, a pair of interviewers had you on their show, and they were talking about other sort of good bad movies, in which they mentioned Troll 2 and The Room. And then when I saw Tommy among the credits of Samurai Cop 2, I thought, what a genius move to put to put him in the picture.
I give all that credit to Greg Hatanaka, the director of the second, who's a fan fanatic of film, and he just thought, man, if I could get Tommy, and it wasn't easy because Tommy's a little scattered, he's just out there, but we did get him down and finally got him, and once Greg releases that Enter the Samurai, which is kind of a behind the scenes of what went on during the filming of Samurai Cop 2 and a little bit of the history of why Samurai Cop became the legendary cult movie, that's supposed to come out around December 2, but Tommy was just an amazing get, and I enjoyed working with him. It was hard to keep a straight face in most of my scenes.
Oh, that's great. So that's going to be released on DVD and stuff as well?
Yeah, he's finally... Greg's been trying to focus on his main line of work because he took a big financial hit with Samurai Cop 2, because as you know, in the business, you really don't make much money.
Yeah.
But so he's trying to put some time together to get that final cut done, but I think it'll be interesting for people to kind of see how Greg's vision in the beginning as a fan of Samurai Cop 2 just really, like Amir, didn't end up the way that he wanted it, and we've got chaos on screen, but again, in its own way, it's kind of interesting. It's like a psychedelic cartoon come to life, Samurai Cop 2 versus the first one. But so once again, we'll see how time tells on that one.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see that documentary. It looks in the trailers and stuff for it. It'll be very interesting to watch. But so, you know, you did a bit of a Terrence Malick and disappeared, and then what in the wilderness years, like, obviously you just went and had a normal life, you just went and got a job and, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't say normal, but I don't know how many interviews you've listened to, but it was I basically kind of stuck around town, and I tried to mainly put myself in places where I thought that I could make connections, and obviously one of them was the gym in Santa Monica, the Santa Monica Bodybuilding Center, where Sly trained, where all of the big wigs in Hollywood came: Tom Cruise, Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson at that time, you know, Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson. So I thought, let me network and maybe I can make connections there of trying to get an agent or this or that and the other thing. And then, so I dabbled in that for a while, and then I kind of got mixed up with the wrong group of guys, was into some nutty crap, and went off and did a little time here for the state of California, and then came back out and finished raising my daughters. And I currently just work in an industry, the trade show industry, where we set up and put on big trade shows like the Comic Cons and LA Auto, big shows, and that's kind of what I do now and have been doing, and I'm in charge of all Southern California. And that also, like I said, a lot of the shows that we do, people recognize me, especially E3, which is the big electronics gaming. We're getting ready this week to set up TwitchCon, which is another, anything that says con in it, people know me. It's just funny because they'll just recognize me. Hey, man, you're the Samurai Cop. And it's just like, I can't, you know, I'm trying to do my job, and everyone's looking at me like, why is that guy taking a picture with you? And it's like, I don't know. So, I mean, it's just funny, but most of the people in my line of work know about it by now, but it's fun. Like I said, it's the right amount of fame, because I said I never really wanted to be famous. I just love the amount of money that you can make in this business, which, of course, most thespians will say is the wrong reason to be in it, but this is the Kardashian era, you know, everyone's out to make a buck, but I just love hearing stories of people when they come up to me and I ask them when they saw it and how they were exposed to it, and it's just never heard anything bad, you know, other than, oh my god, you were horrible, it's hilarious, and I love that, so it's fun.
The common trend is there are good movies, there are bad. I mean, I know people would think Titanic's a crappy movie. So it's beauty's in the eye of the beholder, as they say.
Yeah, no, I don't blame anybody. They're dead on, and I've always agreed with every ridiculed thing pointed out from day one. I'm my hardest critic.
So, I mean, you know, the two different experiences, the Samurai Cop experience and the Samurai Cop 2 experience, both sound like they were, you know, reasonably sort of chaotic productions that were not without their element of chaos, let's say. In contrast, what were the experiences?
I think this one, at least I got a little bit more collaboration with the director, Gregory Hatanaka. He gave me a little more leeway. Obviously, I'm a control freak. Right. And I have certain, like I said, I've done stand-up comedy, and a lot of that is based on your own personal, you write it, you perform it, and there is no third, fourth, fifth input. It's your creative integrity not being, you know, compromised. Here, and obviously with the first movie with Amir, multiple arguments about the dumb dialogue, the horny nurse scene, the nudity, the love scenes, and I would say this is not right. You know, that was me, the young actor, thinking, why would I be making love to this helicopter girl when I'm trying to get with this one? And I would have arguments with Amir, and we actually had an argument just before that love scene that was shot with Melissa and I, Melissa Moore, who played the girl in the helicopter. And that's why you see me giving nothing in that scene. I was just like, fuck that, I'm just going to be an asshole and he won't even use this. And of course, right, everything was used, but that's the immaturity. But again, it's somebody else that's putting up the money. It's, you're hired to do what they want to do. Same thing here with Greg.
Yeah.
We had a lot of discussions because I didn't want to repeat some of the crazy eyes and a lot of the growling and this and that. But Greg said, you got to do it because the fans are expecting it. So me, Matthew Caritas, thespian, 30 years later, wanting to do a better job.
Yeah.
I was kind of torn there. And that's when you have to drop the ego and realize, okay, you know, if that's what he wants, and maybe he thinks this will be funny. So there were scenes where I could just do some better acting, and then other scenes where I had to repeat a lot of the nonsensical stuff that people love. So that's why in the third installment, why I said, you know, I'm going to be writing, controlling, directing everything, and we'll try to go out with third time's a charm. No disrespect to the first two auteurs and directors and so on, but I just felt that Mark and I are going to do this one more time before I turn 55. So that's kind of where we are now, and I'm enjoying, looking forward to that. But it was, that was probably the difference between the one and two, was that I got to be able to give a little bit more input. That scene in Samurai Cop 2, between Mark and I had written that because I felt it was a key point that needed to bond the two characters or give Joe a reason to come back with Frank, you know, out of his reclusive world that he was in after the death of Jennifer. And Greg didn't get it, and I said, no, you don't understand it. Just, we cut from here to an airplane, and it's not enough. And it really played out well, and Mark was thankful that we did it. But those are the kind of things that I can add to. I don't really know how to do, you know, it's a fine line, like I said, to show respect to a director, but I put in what I thought needed to be done, and it did turn out to be okay. So that's where I'm thankful for Greg and him allowing me to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you always run the risk. I mean, I'm a fan of a lot of movies that you would call unintentionally funny. You can't write unintentionally funny. You can't really direct unintentionally funny. Because at the time, I mean, you yourself, you're doing what the director's doing. You're going off your own instinct. You're not trying to be funny.
Correct, and I also take 80% of that performance as horrible acting as a young actor too, besides the dialogue. So it's not, I don't want to always put it all on a mirror that we were yelling our lines really loud and it sounded like this, which was horrible because, you know, he just said, oh, you have to talk louder. I go, but then I'm shouting the line, it doesn't have the subtlety. Anyway, but a lot of it was bad acting. I just thought I was the shit back then, and, you know, look at me, I'm starring in this action movie. So, yeah, I've always wanted to make sure that people understood that. Besides, you know, once you stick a wig on my head that clearly looks like a wig, you're not going to get me given 100%, but whatever.
That was something my wife has long wanted to ask you. After I introduced her to the film, she said, he's wearing a wig. And I said, yeah. She said, but it changes. And so her question was, is it a different wig? Was it a multitude of wigs, or was it one bad wig, or, you know, what was the battle? What was the battle of the wig?
It was one bad wig, and like I said, we filmed the first from June until November with my real hair, and in that time frame, there was a lot of time in between where weeks would go by, and then Amir would look at the footage and say, okay, come back, I need to shoot this and that and the other thing. He finally said November of 1990. we're done, it's in the can, I'll call you when it's ready. So then I went and cut my hair really short, new headshot, so on and so forth. Then he called me in December, January of 91, and I thought I was coming in to pick up some footage of the movie. And he's like, what have you done? I have more to film. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. You told me we were through. So we grabbed one wig on Hollywood and Vine in Hollywood, California. And at the time, he thought it resembled my hair. I did it all. Like I said, it looks like Jacqueline Smith and Charlie's Angels. But I was trying to accommodate, and I thought, all right, far away shots, no one will know. But as you saw, it was many, many close-ups. And then as it kept going on, it just, the humidity in L.A. would curl it up. Nobody was fixing it, styling it. It was falling off in fights and getting dirty. So it's just, that's what became the joke.
Yes.
So yeah, I was just trying to, you know, I felt bad, but on the other hand, I thought this isn't all my fault because this guy said we were done and this is nonsense. But
that was a whole
there
lot
was
of
one wig.
That was a whole lot of wig to try and stuff under that baseball cap you had on.
That was even. That's because I got so fed up with it. I just threw the hat on. I think that day because we were stealing that particular shot in front of a live police station,
right.
And that cop that comes out was a real police officer, and Amir kind of bluffed him through, because the guy goes, what are you guys doing? And Amir says, oh, we're filming a second unit for Hunter, because Amir always was aware of what shows were filming in downtown L.A. that had permits, so he could try to piggyback off that. So the guy, and then he goes, but as a matter of fact, we were waiting for the actor, but can you play the part? And that guy wasn't an actor, he's a real cop. And then we came up and he said something to us and then we drove off, but it was just hilarious the way that he could pull that off.
I love the way it sounds like he would stop and grab shots like Ed Wood.
He had ideas where he wanted to shoot, but he just didn't know the setup until we, like, he said, all right, we're going to go over to the Parker Center and we'll sit out front, let me see if I can. And he would a lot of times film from outside of the back of that van. Remember the van that's in the movie that we do the
drug bust shots
like that, or he'd just set it up real quick and tell me and Mark, all right, quick, run up there. And that's why a lot of that is ADR and voiceover, because he didn't have his mic. We were just lip-syncing it later. Most of that was Amir's voice in that scene. Actually, all the voices and most of it were Amir.
I love the revelation that came out when I was checking out some other interviews that Mark Frazier did some dubbing of character, the character that you're in the editing room with in that one scene.
Yes, we call him Walt Disney, but yeah. And he didn't remember though.
I thought that was great. But, you know, it was very clear that he was, the dude directed like 30 movies, Amir Chavon. I mean, going all the way back, films that he must have made in Tehran, like The Black Suit Thief and Man of City and Captain and Turkmen. And then he comes over to the States and does, like, The Young Rebels and Killing American Skyler and Hollywood Cop is another cop movie.
Yep.
So, did he come across as capable, or was he just very sporadic?
I think he was very capable, but again, like most filmmakers here, you're kind of limited to funding. Obviously, I think he could have done better work had he more fiscal resources.
Right.
And if you watch all of his films, like you had just mentioned, The Young Rebel and so on and so forth, you will see a common thread. It was almost like a Western style. The old Westerns is how Amir shot all that. Lots of guns, especially in my movie, just different, very, you know, like six-shooter revolvers from like the old days,
right,
and big shotguns and so on. But that was his style. And and I've spoken many times and had dinner with his son, Ben, who currently owns all the titles.
Right.
And Amir was a very shrewd businessman. He would make these movies for 10, 20, 30,000, and he would sell them for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars at the film market. So he just always wanted to have the good looking guy, the girls, the boobs, and the action and the guns. And that's what he felt would sell at these film marts overseas. So he would sit there, and when the big movies were being sold to territories that were wanting hundreds of thousands of dollars, Amir would say, hey, I've got something like that, but it's only 10 grand or 30. And he would schmooze, and he was a very, very shrewd businessman, and he supported his family making movies. So, and I think he would have enjoyed this, what had come of that, and been in on it. Yeah, you know what I mean? I don't think he would have been insulted.
Yeah.
I just think it's just funny to look back, and you can really pick apart a movie, and you could see every technical mistake and so on and so forth that he did, but he was trying to make a movie as quickly as possible and turn around and sell it every year at that film mart. So he was just under the time frame of get it done quickly and then with whatever resources I got and make, you know, as much of it for no money at all. A lot of us didn't get paid that much. We were just doing it for the exposure and to, you know, to get some footage for us as actors.
Yeah. Well, one thing that stood out to me was it seems to be a film of odd cutaways, and the cutaways, from what you've said in other interviews, were filmed after the fact, like the cutaway to Frank, like Frank's reaction. I think you said in another interview, like, you came back and did some, like, you know, your responses were done like several days later in a different room.
An assembly line in that. It was Vermeer's office, and he would just do various pickup shots, and that's why we always looked like we were all sitting in the same area. But and Mark, with his looks and his, because he was so confused. Mark was a very well trained New York actor, and this was his first starring role,
right?
So he didn't get it when we would just randomly be just sitting there, and Amir would go, "Okay, Mark, stand up, stand over there. Okay, now laugh." And Mark has no motivation. He doesn't understand the context. He doesn't know where this is going to be inserted, where it's from. Is it coming up? Has we already shot it?
Yeah.
So poor Mark with his, you know, and then he would just consistently look in the camera. There was no discipline for any of us after a certain point. We were like, this is crazy. We just got to get out of this thing. Yeah. And we'd show up and do the best we could to appease Amir.
And Robert Zadar, someone I always wanted to get in touch with. I never did. He sadly passed away. Was it like working with The Face, as he was known, Robert Zadar?
I had met him briefly when I was with Stallone and we were filming Tango and Cash over on the Warner Brothers lot, and I remembered him distinctly, obviously, because of his face.
Yeah.
And then come to find a couple of years later, here he is on the set, and we didn't really have that many scenes together except for the climatic sword fight at the end. But he also was very serious in what he did there, you know, and I thought, wow, you know, it's just weird. He's doing this non-union movie, but he was in Tango. So I always had this illusion of a different type of Hollywood that you would slowly keep going and going. Now, he was a character actor, I get that.
Yeah.
But Maniac Cop and some other movies, and he was typecast, obviously, by his look. Yeah. And every scene that we did or anything that you watch him do, he's very serious about it. He didn't, you know, he would have some blow-ups with a mirror on set because it obviously wasn't a big budget movie, and he was getting dirty and wanted to shower, and there was none of those type of accommodations. But kudos to him for really being a professional. And like I said, we didn't have that many conversations together, and I was really sad that with the two attempts that we tried to fly him out for the sequel, one was delayed because of weather, and the second, obviously, he had ailing health, and then of course he succumbed to his kidney and problems and died just before we could get him back. We put his little homage there. I don't know if you caught it in the sequel on the TV, great guy and legendary fan base too. A lot of people loved his work.
One question I've always been wanted to ask is why did he feel that, do you know why he felt the need to speed up the film in certain places, like in the sword fight? The film is sped up there. Is that because you were going too slow, or they just, you know?
I think because Gerald Nakamura was giving Robert and I choreography for the fight scenes, and I, of course, argued, saying, I don't think this is how samurai fights go. It's not a swashbuckling Errol Flynn type fight. It's more or less a chess game of posturing and moving and leaving an opening and seeing if your opponent will take it, and then it's one, either he's going to get you or you'll get him, meaning you baited him and then you cut his head or whatever. But because those swords, you know, when you see in the close-ups, they're all dinged up. It was just ridiculous. But even the car scenes, the car chase scenes, because we were driving in and around neighborhoods that were 30 mile an hour.
Right.
So we weren't trying to, you know, when we crashed into garbage cans and this and that, that would be a neighbor's house. And we'd have the neighborhood kids flocked around watching this moron in a wig running around, you know, it's just, but that's kind of his, I think, style of how he tried to make it look, you know, but it does come across as Benny Hill-ish, you know, so it was funny.
Yeah.
I thought it was, but that's just creative filmmaking. That's what made it such a legendary gem.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, a lot of actors strive very hard to, you know, I mean, they go, you know, some actors go looking for certain films that they think will advance them. You're the opposite. You kind of stumble into a film that would go on to have a cult following. You know, as an actor, from the actor's side of things, like, was that, you know, now looking back on it with the time and all that sort of stuff, is it something that, you know, if you could do it again and you were going out looking for parts, you know, would you have chosen something sort of say, I think that would be a good movie to, to be in. Like, I know a lot of actors sort of say, well, if I wouldn't watch it, I wouldn't be, was that,
Yeah, but I think the script, when I first met Amir, and again, I met him through one of the fellow bodyguards with Sly Boyle Gorick, who had done, I think, a couple of days' work on maybe Killing American Style, and he said, Matt, you got to get out there, you got to get some tape, go see this guy named Amir, and I literally walked into his office, and he just loved the Stallone look, the similarity, even though I don't compare my, obviously I'm 6'3", Sly's 5'10", but there was a slight, I get it, physical features, so on and so forth, but, so I was so thankful that, as the minute I walk in, he goes, oh, that's it, you're the star of my movie, this is a lethal weapon type, low budget action, and you're going to be the Mel Gibson part. And I thought, wow, and I read the script, and he said, if you want to change anything, well, we can, which is just a way to get me to do it.
Yeah.
And literally a week later, we started filming. So I still think I would have enjoyed that opportunity. I'm still thankful that he gave me that opportunity, because I had only done one small part in that American Revenge movie that another friend had given me. So I was slowly working my way up, and I really thought, okay, if I shoot this movie, even when we were filming it and I knew it would not be fantastic, I thought there's got to be some pieces that I can kind of cut out and put on a reel. And it was really, I was very hard pressed to find anything that I could use that, because either I was a horrible actor or the dialogue was ridiculous, or I was screaming my lines because Amir didn't have any body mics and we were yelling to boom mics that were 20, 30 yards away.
Right.
So no, I don't think I would change it. And I still am very appreciative of what it was. And because of that, here I was at 50 years old shooting a sequel because of it. And I kind of got a second shot at it. And it just more or less let me know, there's kind of a time frame of when you're at your peak. And in this town, I'm more of a reality personality than an actor. I still enjoy trying to get in there and get it right. But my true calling, I still love the stand-up just because it's just something that I can control and own. But now it's a little harder because of what's happened. So I just felt now I'm kind of locked in and obsessed with doing this thing and finishing it and doing a good movie, and who knows if the fans want that, but I think most of the response is, we just want to see you and Mark together, we love seeing you guys, and it's kind of like that underdog story. They feel you guys got shafted, and you probably could have worked had you were given, good projects coming along and taking small parts in big movies, and I would have developed as an actor, as an apprentice, got better and better and better, and looked at my performance and go, oh, I got to change this, I can't do this. That's what would the natural progression be. But, 30 years have passed. Tom Cruise started, he was in 82. Look at him now, and he's the same age as I. So, but he's got a plethora of films, and he's a great talent. But he had a lot of opportunities slowly from Taps to this to that. You know what I mean? All the Right Stuff. And then he started getting, and then he gets one big hit. I mean, imagine if I could have been given the Die Hard role that, Bruce Willis had gotten. Now, again, that script itself is amazing. You could put, now Bruce Willis came from television, Moonlighting. He wasn't a big star, but that movie launched him.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? It's just being at the right time, getting the right property, and fitting into what needs to be done. And you can just, like Sly said, you can become a star overnight. It's based on the fans accepting you. And then once you've got them, then, you're fine. And that's kind of inadvertently what's happened. These Cole fans are a frenetic bunch, and they can make or break careers. It's a crazy world. But Trek fans, I mean, it's a lot of, and I consider them connoisseurs, basically, to find a piece of crap movie like, Samurai Cop.
Yeah.
And to enjoy the subtleties of it, that takes a certain type of viewer. It's not the average guy who would sit down and put on Samurai Cop, would turn it off in 30 seconds, going, this is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
But some people go, no, you got to look deeper. Look, there's something else here. Forget the surface. This is amazing. Look at this nonsense. And that's what is an eclectic bunch of fans that I enjoy, because they really found the nuttiness and made it what it was. But no, I wouldn't change a thing. I think I would have hoped to put myself into better opportunities to kind of grow as an actor. But now, like I said, at 55, I mean, I'm not turning down anything. Like I've said in other interviews, Quentin Tarantino's a huge fan of Samurai Cop. And if he ever said, hey, I got a small part in a movie, I'd be there in a second, He launched Travolta's career as a revival, so you just never know. So I'm open to that, but I'm kind of being realistic. This kind of is what it is.
That will be fantastic, actually. I hope. I hope that comes off. I want to see that. But, hey, that's, knowing
that's
him,
the Samurai Cop.
Yeah, knowing
and
him.
And I'm also cognizant of the fact that I'm kind of a one-note actor at this point. I know my range is extremely minimal, so I'm not looking to do Leonardo DiCaprio stuff relevant. you know, Revelator, whatever the movie, you know what I mean? I kind of know what I could do, but there's a lot of people out there that are working in that same type of range that make great money, and it's just kind of nothing special, but they're interesting, or they have some type of background that makes the fans say, "Hell, I'd love to see him in something," and that's flattering, and that's always welcome from my point of view.
And knowing Quentin, he'll probably credit you as Matt Hannon.
Yeah, I don't mind. You can call me Fred Farkle for all as long as you give me a movie.
Just for nostalgic reasons, but I mean, at the same time, you know, we're talking about this movie. No one sets out to make a bad movie, though, do they? No one sets out to make a piece of crap. Like, they, Amir probably said, didn't he? He said, well, you know, I'm going to make an action movie. That's what they want, action. You know, you don't, you know, same with the sequel. You don't, that's why I thought a sequel would always be dangerous, because how are you going to match something or rekindle something that was completely accident in a lot of ways? You know?
Right.
A happy accident.
Yeah, and that's what we tried to avoid with the sequel with Greg, but we threw in the little subtleties just for the fans, but for whatever reason, he actually had the same almost circumstances that Amir did. You know, we were running out of time, we couldn't film, he had to make things up on the fly, and that's why people look at it now and think, oh, they did that on purpose, and he really didn't. And I think that documentary will show that we just had a lot of the same accidental coincidences of just low budget movie making, where, you know, you can't go back to a sound stage that we're on, so Greg finds a brick wall that looks similar and we stand in front of it, or, you know what I mean, and people can pick up on that and go, what the fuck, why? So that kind of stuff happens, but it's not intentional, but it is what it is. And that's the danger of when the first script that Greg presented me for the sequel, it was nothing what you saw in that final. So that's how he just had to start hacking away. We can't afford this, we can't do that now. And that's when the artistic integrity starts just getting destroyed, and all he's trying to do is piece together a beginning, middle, and end. And there was a lot of drama that went on with Tommy, with Caden Cross. We didn't know if certain people were going to show up, by Ling. So he actually started filming alternate storylines just in case so-and-so couldn't come in or so-and-so quit. And then when you get done filming, now you have five different storylines, and now you got to try to make them all make sense. And that's why it was so confusing to everybody. What is Caden's? Is she the dead wife, or she, why does she wear a blonde wig, and it was, so first she was a detective, then she was a bad girl, and then she's Tommy's sister, and it's like, what the fuck is going on? So that's why I said, people look at it like, I just watched that movie and it was visually stunning, but I have no idea what I saw. And I said, that's what I said, that wasn't intentional, but that's what it ended up being.
I love in the sequel they got a good portion of the original cast back. One of the surprises for me was to get, and I'm going to mess up his name here probably, but Yoselito Rescobar.
Oh, yeah. Yoselito Rescobar, yes, yeah. We found him reluctantly. He kept ignoring Greg's Facebook invitations because they thought he was a crazy man, and his kids kept going, no, Dad, this is for the movie that you did. And what we came to find out after interviewing him, he was actually the producer of all of Amir's films. He had the money. He was a doctor.
Oh, wow.
And he had quite a lot of money, and he helped contribute and was in all of, you know, Amir's movie. He played the Indian in one movie and something in another, and then he played the gay waiter, of course, in ours. But, yeah, he was great to have back. He's very much into religion now, and he's a preacher or something like that, but it was very fun to film with him that day on the airplane. That wasn't even what he was intended to do. He showed up, and we happened to have a 747 set that day, and we changed and made him a steward on it, and we created the dialogue and so on for that scene. But again, it was just fun to get him back. My buddy Tom Gleason, who was the one-armed guy, we thought that was hilarious. He came back with a little prosthetic arm with a couple rubber gloves on. I mean, so I had written that scene, and I thought that would be a good way to bring Tom back in, and he was actually wearing the exact same shirt that he had on 30 years ago with both sleeves cut off. So those are little things that we got, but we didn't know if diehard fans would pick up on. But everybody that we got back, Cranston, and he did another amazing job. I think he does a better performance than myself, obviously, in the first and second, but he's not even an actor. But the only one was reluctantly. We did find the girl whose name at that time, Jennifer.
Janice Farley.
Janice, her name's changed, and she's moved on and wanted nothing to do with it. I respected that. She's got, you know, a different life now, but I wish she could have came back because it would have made a little bit more sense, and I think maybe I can lure her back for the third, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Just because the budget will be in the $4 or $5 million range, so she might be, okay, this sounds... But anyway, so yeah, to get everybody back, that was nice. I think the fans enjoyed seeing all that, and we just couldn't find the horny nurse, never knew what her name was, could never find any documentation of her name as an actress, and then, of course, the redhead girl that plays the Here Comes the Boss all the time.
Yeah.
Would have been nice to get, but, you know, we'll see.
Have you listened to it with the Joe Bob's commentary?
Yes, yeah. That's the first one I think I ordered on Amazon and watched and just laughed, and that's what I had seen. I loved all that. And even Riff Trax had recently done a live Riff Trax of Samurai Cop, and that was hilarious too. And I was so thankful they actually edited out that dumb love scene and a lot of the dumb foul language, because I think it would play better to a bunch of kids. Teenage kids would love it. But there's that gratuitous sex scenes with Robert and the other, you know, so that was cut out in that live, and I was thankful for that because I was in the theater with a packed house.
Yeah.
We actually sold out two theaters in Burbank when that played. But and that was a bunch of fans. You know, I introduced the film. I said, how many of you have seen Samurai Cop? Not one hand went up, but they were huge Riff Trax fans. So I was like, oh, well, then I don't really need to say much here. I'm just, it's self-explanatory. I'll see you at the end. And then, of course, standing ovations. And then they all came out and greeted me when I left and clapped. And I talked with everybody. So it was fun to introduce that to a bunch of new fans that had never seen it and have them had the Riff Trax over it to enjoy it and mock it and make fun of it.
Yeah, I loved his with your speech there in the first one in the bar there. He says this is a speech that Matt obviously highlighted in his script. You know, the I'm here to tell all you motherfuckers that
you sons of bitches. I had told Amir over and over. I said we don't say that in our language. We would say sons of bitches, not son of a bitches. And he says, no, I don't like. Please just say it the way. And I said, all right. But yeah, I had that thing memorized. And like I said, I was in his office, not even in the restaurant, because he'd never filmed the reverse angle of that.
Right,
and just sitting there talking to a lamp and just pissed off. Like, I can't believe I'm sitting here doing this. And it's 80 degrees. I got a leather coat on. I'm sweating in here. And it's like, so yeah, that was just, it's whatever. Like I said, I look back at it and it's hilarious. But it, that was me. I think trying to do a good job, but also being frustrated that, it was horrible all the way around. Just bad acting. Yeah. It was terrible.
Well, I thought it was great. I'm sorry.
No, I know. Yeah, it's okay. Great. Yeah, that it was just ridiculous. It's like, look at this tool.
In the context of the movie, I think it was
brilliant. Yeah.
But I loved Joe Bob's whole analogy. Like, in Hollywood, you have a golden age, and then there's a silver age, and then in this case, a counterfeit peso age. But also another thing I loved was in another interview of yours, they compared the on-screen meeting of you and Tommy as De Niro and Pacino in Heat.
Yeah, that's what I tried to sell him when Greg said, come on, let's meet Tommy for dinner. And Tommy was literally 3 hours late. And I was just like, what the fuck? Who is this guy? Because I knew nothing about him, never saw the room.
Right.
And so when we're sitting at the table, I was trying to explain, we'd love to have you because I think the fans would love, this genre of, they just love cult movies, good, bad actors. He says, I'm not the bad actor. I said, oh okay. I mean, I'm a bad. So then I had to realize, oh, okay, this guy still is a little, and then I said, they just want to see, it's like Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson playing one-on-one and De Niro. But yeah, he really took offense to me saying, we're just two horrible actors that people laughed at. And he's like, I wasn't horrible. And I'm like, oh. So it kind of hit me like, wow, all right, this guy believes
his own stuff.
Yeah, no disrespect, everybody, I mean, he can be entitled to, but I mean, Tommy was absolutely worth every penny that we paid him for that sequel, because anytime he is on camera, he is entertaining beyond belief. Now, whether or not he thinks it's a different degree of entertaining is his perception, but I think most of us are kind of in on it. And like I said, kudos to the guy. I mean, when this film comes out, and obviously, I don't know if you've already heard, there's Oscar buzz for James Franco playing Tommy as Tommy Wiseau and the Disaster Artist, either as a director or as an actor. I mean, that would be quite the irony if this guy wins. But you do have to take your hat off to Tommy because, regardless of how Tommy got the money, which obviously there's a documentary out there called Room Full of Spoons that I watched when I was invited to Madrid, Spain, that was played at a film festival.
Right.
And it talks about where that money came from in a wealthy woman, and there might have been some shadiness, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But Tommy still didn't just talk about what he could do. Like I used to say, oh, if I could do this and that and the other thing. He did it.
Right.
He got the money. He went out, and good or bad, he completed a film and whatever amount of money was spent. Just like Greg Hatanaka did, just like Amir did, they made a film. And it's very hard to do that, and you can talk – you know, as much as you want about, oh, I could do it better, this and that. Well, then go do it. And to really do it and pull it off is very hard to do. Greg Hatanaka, from the time that I announced, hey, I'm alive, everybody, and literally a year later, that thing was in theaters, played across the United States and all over the world. And I flew to London at the premiere there, and I went to Madrid for the premiere there, and so on and so forth. And that's an amazing, with no advertising. Greg had nothing on Sunset Boulevard, no advert. It was just word of mouth. And it played in every single city, and you know, for a night or two, the diehard fans came. But that's an amazing thing to have two rewrites, shoot it in like 3-4 weeks around Christmas, edit it, and have it in theaters within a year. It's unheard of. So that's why I said, no, good, bad, or whatever, I take my hat off to Greg and his achievement there.
Yeah, but no, totally. Like you just said, I mean, it's very easy for a lot of people, critics and, you know, whoever else nowadays, everyone's got a soapbox, but it's very easy to rubbish a movie. But like you said, hey, go out and try and make one. And,
yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to the degree where Greg had it in theaters, had deals with, you know, that anybody can take a camera and put something on YouTube. I get that. But
yeah,
to really get it out there and distribute it and have posters made and to do that Kickstarter, that was quite a task to send posters and all the things that go along with the fundraising all around the world. There's a lot of, and Greg honored all that. You know, people wanted t-shirts or me signing Blu-rays and this and that. And poor guy, you know, like I said, he's still trying to fiscally recover from that, but he will eventually. But it's just, I'm very thankful that he was that much of a fan and he gave me that opportunity to make that sequel. Without him, we would have never done it, along with, you know, the fans' interest.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about briefly about there about James Franco playing Tommy. Wouldn't it be ironic if somewhere, in some sort of alternate universe, you know, Samurai Cop was that big of a cult following that they decided to do a big budget version and someone like Tom Cruise played you or something like that?
Yeah, but no, that would be, I think Tommy's is unique in that. I mean, we are in that same cult bubble, but I think Samurai Cop has to stand, because it wasn't just, there's nothing unique about it. I mean, it's unique because of its craziness, and I think that in and of itself is enough, and I think that's why it's important. I feel that we at least do a trilogy and kind of either glaze over the second one and just pick up where are Frank and Joe 30 years later, and I've got that story, and we've got this thing traveling, you know, to Tenerife and then to Madrid and back to London, to New York, LA, and San Diego. That's all in the script. So we're trying to make it a traveling picture where all the fans, because that's where a majority of the fans are, UK, U.S. and over in Spain, huge fan bases. So I thought, you know, and we got a lot of interest with the tourism in those countries who put up some cash because they felt, yeah, this would be beautiful. And I think it's an amazing, you know, thing to track because it's kind of taking it full circle. And that's why I said, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. And it's going to be what I have on the page is what we're going to put on film. And I'm really a stickler for music and soundtrack and stuff like that is very expensive. Some of the music that I want to use, a lot of stuff that Greg had in the original cut, you know, we couldn't license because they're wanting $10,000 or $40,000. It's like, come on, guys, we're fucking low budget. So that way I'm working it backwards as far as music around story and then locations. And I think people will enjoy it when it comes out. It should be done and ready for that 30-year anniversary in 2020. We'll release it at Comic-Con in San Diego.
That'll be huge. So do you have a title yet? It's not just the Samurai Cop 3, is it?
No, I don't even know if we were going to, even touch base. I think the fans will know. It's kind of being made as if, you know, the fans will know that it's a third installment, but maybe it could also be out there as just a low-budget movie. Who knows? Like I said, we just don't know as far as how Frank and Joe, but I don't think it'll be as farcical as the second. And it would probably be a throwback to the old 90s-style action movies, because nowadays, you know, everyone's floating in the air and, you know, spinning with special effects. We're trying to just kind of do an old school Bad Boys or, you know, Lethal Weapon, whatever. I think that's kind of what Amir would have wanted to do had he had the opportunity to make that type of a film.
Yeah. Hey, I've got a title for you.
Okay.
For it. The Last Samurai Cop.
That's just me in my everyday life. We've gotten so many people that have ways that they'd love to see this shot. Even when we were doing the sequel, they were like, oh, I hope you do this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, you can't please, everybody has different versions. That's why I said you can't really mess with magic. It's just, it is what it is. But like Mark said, let's just do it before I die, man. I'm 70 or 16, well, odd years old, because I can't keep waiting. So that's kind of why we were just laughing about. Yeah. Where's there going to be two old fucks out there on the... But it'll be an inside thing, and if it's marketed right, you can recoup your funds that way. I know Netflix sometimes will pre-buy and so on and so forth, but I think it's mainly just to do it, and who knows how big the audience is. Like I said, we don't know what's going to come of Tommy's movie coming out, and then maybe people are like, well, what did the guy do since The Room? And maybe they'll say, oh, he was in a movie called Samurai Cop 2. You just never know how the world and the connections, you know, some big studio exec's got a son who just goes, oh my God, Dad, I love this movie. And then all of a sudden they're calling you in to say, hey, we'd like to help you on this. Or, you know, you just, you don't know. So that's kind of where we're just, it's fun every day waking up seeing what's new today.
I definitely think the cult of yourself and Tommy at the moment is pretty ripe. So, I mean, it's a good time.
Yeah, it's, you know, strike. Actually, and with the video game coming out too now, it's they made a video game, Samurai Cop. It's been in about a year in production, but it's a retro style video game, as if the movie, 1990, that's when the video came out, and that's kind of hot right now too. Nostalgia video, old school. Yeah. And it's funny, I've seen a lot, and I work with the guy that designed it, and we had some funny story, things that would be on it, so we'll see how that goes, but it really is, like you said, it's all about timing and the cult worlds, and it's just funny that Tommy and I look similar because of our hair and everything else, so it's like, who are these two knuckleheads? They're like the Barbarian Brothers from the 80s, and they separated at birth, one of them's... looks like a vampire. The other guy looks like
there's a movie
Stallone
there.
With Down syndrome.
There's a movie there. You guys could do like that Van Damme movie, Double Impact, where you play two brothers.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think Tommy would work again.
No.
With me, I don't. Especially now, he's probably thinking, "Oh no, I am only for big movies now. I don't mess around with." I mean, who knows?
You do. I tell you what, you do him very well. You might have a career.
No, that James Franco did him amazing. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for the. I mean, he's it's incredible.
But you've got I think you've got a. You've got something to go. You're doing pretty well.
Well, yeah, he's got a certain cadence, but it's just mainly, like I said, I think everyone's going to enjoy that behind-the-scenes footage, because believe me, we had cameras rolling any time Tommy was on set, and he's just so entertaining. Yeah, like I said, even the rehearsals of him and I. He couldn't remember the choreography of, left, right, up, down, kick, spin, this, that. He just, and it was just hilarious to hopefully be, like I said, we had live samurai swords and close-ups, and we were wondering, shit, is he going to forget and cut my arm off? Or are we going to... So it'll be fun. I think it's something to look forward to.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely looking forward to that. I can't wait to see the documentary. Sincerely hope, Matt, that you get... Please feel free to use that title, The Last Samurai Cop. I hope you get that into fruition. It sounds really cool. Personally, I see a fourth one. You could come down and get here and do...
down in Australia. And do, absolutely. Do the Samurai... I'll make it over there someday, believe me. You I'll
need
travel.
To, you do need to do the fourth one, which will be the Samurai Cop Down Under.
Yep. It'll be a Crocodile Dundee kind of spoof rip-off. I don't know.
Where you cut your way out of the jaws of a giant crocodile or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah, cash in on that.
In a wheelchair. I'm already, like I said, 55. How much longer? They're 30 years too late for my...
Well, maybe maybe in the fourth one you could play like the old master who teaches the new...
I'll hire a young actor kid to play me in the younger years.
Yeah, and you can teach the new samurai cop. You can be like the old master now, finally.
Yes.
But, Matt, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. They thought that Matt Hannon had gone the way of the tagline of the first movie, which was, you have the right to remain silent, dead silent. But it turns out he wasn't dead. He was just chilling out. He was just cooling off as the other
thing. Just cooling off.
Yeah. But, Matt, it's been absolutely... As a fan first, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you this morning.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Like I said, fun to have the admiration. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I hope everything that's going on around Samurai Cop, the cult of Samurai Cop, pays off, with the video game and the documentary and third installment and all that sort of thing. So I hope it all goes well, and I hope you and Tommy remain good friends.
Yeah. Get together and do something of quality soon.
I love that. That was a great line. You're a bad actor. I'm not a bad actor.
Yeah, he goes, he was so just right on it, too. He's like, I'm not a bad actor. I said, and I had to just quickly, I said, I offended him. He's out of here. And Greg's looking at me, and I thought he was in on it. I thought he knew. I mean, That's all right.
Yeah. Well, I think Tommy's drank his Kool-Aid a long time ago. So he's
yeah, but God bless the guy. Like I said, he's a unique individual and one of a kind.
Yeah, and that's certainly that film, like you said, with James Franco, looks like it's going to be
awesome. It's going to be good, man. I can't wait.
Yeah. Have you read the book?
No, I've heard about it. I actually just finally, 2 months ago, went and watched a live screening here in Westwood, California. Of Tommy's The Room. It plays every month, and I went in and snuck in the back. Of course, everybody recognized me.
Oh, no. Yeah. Hey, the Samurai Cop's watching The Room.
Because there's a lot of crossover, fan base, and I'm trying to lay low, but I don't know, maybe they thought, what? But the guy, even the theater owner recognized me. He goes, oh, would you like to introduce the film? I go, no, this is Tommy's Room, not mine.
I just want to watch it.
He goes, oh, all right. But the fans are so, it's just amazing how they just interact like a Rocky Horror Picture Show, and there's just, everybody's yelling out one-liners, and it's really a fun event if you ever get a chance to see one in Australia. I know he plays it all over the world.
Yeah, but I haven't seen it in a theater yet, I think.
So I'm looking forward to it. I think that'll be a good movie, and I hope that it's well-received here by the Hollywood, and it sparks some interest about all those lost, talented people from the early 90s that are just washed-up union workers looking for a handout.
Yeah. Well, Matt, it's been a real thrill, mate. If you ever make it down and send us an email, we'll get together and have a beer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll do. We'll arrange the screening and find some other guys. Maybe the other 4 people in Australia that love the movie.
Well, you know, I'm one of them, so it won't be hard to track.
No, I know. That's a unique club. Yeah. Kudos to you.
It's like a
million miles airline club. It's just very few get into it. So I'm honored to have you there.
Yeah. All right, mate. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you.